This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zack. I'm your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger sits down with Gavin Wild, who serves as a senior fellow in the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. They discuss Russian interference in U.S. elections, continued Russian cyber espionage and attacks on American institutions of democracy, and the outlook of the 2024 election and its security.
Gavin Wild, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you are a senior fellow in technology and international affairs program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where you bring expertise on Russia and cyber-related issues, to which, as we will discuss, Gavin, there is no shortage of. Now, of course, you came from the world of government before you entered the world of think tankery in Washington, D.C., having served in the White House National Security Council staff and the National Security Agency, the NSA. Tell me about your work in the NSA and how that brought you to the world of Russia and cyber intrusion issues.
Well, what little I can say, as far as my work at the NSA, I had the opportunity, probably first and foremost that I can say, is that examining the way Russia thinks about information warfare and cyber conflict and all of those things, most prominently kind of looking at their efforts to undermine and influence and interfere, whichever word you decide to use, in the 2016, 2018, and 2020 elections over the course of my career. Those were kind of areas that I had the opportunity to try to make a difference from both an intelligence perspective in the IC, and then in 2018 and 2019 when I was at the National Security Council trying to kind of put together some policy around cybersecurity and around election security and countering foreign malign influence. So had some great experiences there. Can't speak enough about what an honor it was to spend that time in public service.
Well, and we thank you for that service. And it was certainly a hezzy time, 2016 through 2020, in dealing with this issue set. Let's just kind of baseline this, Gavin. I mean, the bottom line is, Russia, Vladimir Putin's Russia, is or is not seeking to, I'll use the verb, interfere with U.S. elections. That was certainly true in 2016. Does that continue to be true today?
I think so. I think it's safe to say both A, that we should always operate on the assumption that he is, because that's going to make us safer than not. But I think also all of the incentives and the interests of Russia as it currently is, I think, are inclined towards that kind of disruption.
Now, you of course are a student of Russia. That was what your academic training was, Russian studies. So unpack interference. Kind of what is the optimal outcome for the Russian operatives here? What are they trying to do? I mean, we're a country of 330 plus million people. Democracy, its essence is a messy thing. We have highly paid political strategists, consultants, and very smart people trying to get elected and trying to shape public opinion in the United States, and they have trouble doing that. I mean, to what extent from an adversary like Russia can they actually be successful in their objective? Is it simply just to gum everything up and divide America? For them, that's success, and therefore, the more division there is, the more they're succeeding?
Well, I think what I would foot stomp in terms of Moscow and have, periodically throughout my career, is that particularly in the information environment, whether we're talking about, propaganda or cyber operations, Moscow does not perceive itself as transgressing some norm, but rather acting in rigid adherence to one. And by that, I mean particularly the information environment is a contested one, where if you're not controlling it, it's being controlled for you. And I would say a lot of Russia's strategic culture, going back, hundreds of years, thinks in terms of information and social engineering as kind of part and parcel. And so there's a little bit of, well, there's a lot of conspiratorialism and a kind of underlying assumption that narratives and kind of public sentiment can be shaped and molded, and that there's a science beneath it, that information behaves according to the laws of physics that are yet to be discovered but can ultimately be kind of harnessed. And so they've long approached the information environment in both kind of relative peacetime and wartime as one that states can have some kind of a real legitimate sway over. And that's often served them poorly, as I would argue it has in Ukraine and elsewhere, in both A, overestimating how much states can actually do and with any kind of reasonable expectation of impact, but also in us underestimating their kind of their victims' ability to adapt and evolve in that same vein.
That's a good point. So, I mean, they think this is happening, that if they're not shaping the narrative, someone else is shaping the narrative. This happens, as you note, in peacetime and in wartime. I want to get to wartime a little bit. Obviously, you and I spent some time together discussing Ukraine on an event in Capitol Hill not too long ago. But staying in the past, prior to Ukraine, prior to Russians' invasion and war of aggression against Ukraine in February of 2022, you know, they were still engaging in this stuff. It strikes me that, you know, they interfered, attempted to interfere in the 2016 election, but the real interference was absorbed when kind of our federal authorities and other players got wind of this, didn't really know what to do with it, and imagined things that they were doing that they weren't doing, and didn't know they were doing things that they were doing. And it just resulted in further conspiracies that actually, I think, accrued to the benefit of Russia, perhaps not because of their superior planning or ability to carry it out, but they got everybody thinking about it and wrapped up in it. Give me your take, or whether or not that's a generally correct way to think about what happened in their interference in 2016.
Well, so I love I love to borrow a phrase that I think Michael Shermer kind of coined, which is kind of my hop, lie hop, and cow hop are the three kind of ways to think about this. Made it happen on purpose, let it happen on purpose, or capitalized on what happened on purpose. And I think Russia's very, very, very good at the third one, very good at the second one. Making it happen on purpose, I think, sometimes risks lending Moscow a little bit too much credit for kind of dynamics that were already well in play, and certainly removes our own agency from the equation. And I think in terms of when we talk about Russian attempts at interfering in electoral processes or undermining democracy, which they certainly are seeking to do, we often fail to account for the domestic political conditions which make kind of fertile ground for those efforts that we have a little bit more control over, and that we have some capacity to kind of answer for or improve. And so I think drawing hard lines between those kind of three dynamics is very difficult. 2016 is one of the most extensively kind of documented between the Mueller report and the Senate and House reports and the intelligence community reports. And so I'll you know, leave it to your listeners and viewers to kind of tease out where that line may be. But I think more broadly, I guess I would just foot stomp that, you know, Russia's certainly nefarious, but we domestically have a role to play.
Yeah, and then you were emphasizing that the other day when we were together talking on Ukraine. We'll get there in a minute. But beyond 2016, we get to 2020, you're in government and you're trying to improve how the United States becomes more resilient and doesn't allow itself to be victims of this interference, whether it's domestic politics or something else. How do you think we're doing as a country on that front as we sit here in early 2024? We have two likely, you know, the general election will likely be between President Joe Biden and President Donald Trump. What are your thoughts going in to what will be a hotly contested and divisive election as you think about what Russia may want to do?
I think from a technical perspective, we've actually made a lot of good progress. I mean, you have a whole lot of kind of conversations Within and across and between governments, both, you know, in the U.S. domestically, as well as with partners and allies, and with the private sector, in trying to make sure that the technical machinery of casting votes and tabulating votes is secure. And, you know, I had the good pleasure of working with Chris Krebs for a bit, and I think the work that he's done and that was carried on by Jen Easterly at CISA, and certainly by, you know, both White Houses, I'll give them both credit. I think they did a fantastic job of kind of making that technical and cybersecurity aspects of voting a real conversation in a space where folks can collaborate to make sure it's as secure and can be counted on as accurate and legitimate. On the kind
referring
of
direct, to those players inside the, you know, Department of Homeland Security that are given the responsibility for working cybersecurity, particularly the private sector as well, and part of that is ensuring that our elections, the technical pieces, you note, are not interfered with.
Indeed, and I would say, you know, hats off as well. You know, during my time, I think at the NSC under the Trump White House, had some great leadership there that made this a priority and helped us kind of steer Executive Order 13848 and some of those other kind of documents and national strategies to get a grip on some of these security measures. Did a great job and some amazing and smart folks chipping away at that over the last several years. And so I think we certainly can't rest on our laurels, but I think there's room to turn around and say, wow, we've come a long way since 2016.
Now, I know you focus on Russia. China, the National Intelligence Council determined was not involved, did not interfere in a formal sense, a state-directed sense, I guess, in our last election. Do you expect that to stay the same? And why wouldn't China get in on what the Russians have done? And they seem to be involving themselves, for example, in the war in Gaza by actively trying to shape public opinion against Israel in favor of Hamas or certainly Gazans. What's your kind of outlook towards China as we think about the upcoming election interference?
So I'm by no means a China expert, but I think in the quote-unquote cognitive or psychological space or in that more fuzzy propaganda and kind of influence space, as it were, that's where things get a little bit tougher. It's harder to kind of point to an international norm or international law or something kind of in physical space that doesn't work the way it should have, like a voting machine, due to some interference. In the cognitive space, it's a little bit tougher and fuzzier. And I think all states have kind of ways of expressing their will through, you know, direct strategic communications or via proxies, etc., in ways that kind of feel like an affront to our kind of national interest or our sense of kind of sovereignty.
Yeah, I would think. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a tougher nut to crack. We tried again with Executive Order 13848 to kind of split this idea of technical interference and kind of the fuzzier influence operations for the public. But I don't know that there's hard and fast kind of understandings there. And I would guess, insofar as, you know, China practices a lot of more assertive diplomacy, if you will, and is very actively trying to shape global narratives, I don't know where that's going to fall down on elections, but that's not a very satisfying answer.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's an honest one, and I guess it's a we'll see. We think about what the Biden administration has done, and this is where we're moving into Russia's war on Ukraine. One of the things that we saw was this deterrence by disclosure, or an attempt to deter Russia's invasion by disclosing their movements into Ukraine and demonstrating that the world was watching and trying to deter them from ultimately invading, which failed. But it was this moment where you had sensitive intelligence, reportedly, that was being unclassified or declassified, so it could be used to deter the adversary. Do you see any of that being applied to what a state actor might try to deploy in the context of election? We did have these, the hack and drop strategy that Russia used, where they're going ahead and hacking in and leaking information that would be harmful to one campaign or the other. This happened with the Clinton campaign, for example. And you could imagine that you need the intelligence community to come in and say, hey, this was hacked. This is a foreign actor, engaging here and responsible for it. Kind of take me through that sort of activity and how we might as a government respond.
So at least in my experience, like I think back to 2016 and how, what a watershed moment it was for some of us involved in that report to realize that we, the IC, are now treating the American public as a consumer, and we're gonna try to craft something that speaks directly to them about Russia, one of our hardest targets, and we're gonna do so in a way that doesn't jeopardize how we do our job. That was kind of an interesting moment. It was a little bit unprecedented. And I think it's probably wise the way that since then, leaders have judiciously tried to look for ways to kind of make sure that we, the intelligence community, and certainly as regards elections, are not in a perpetual state of kind of figuring out who shot John, but rather trying to get ahead of it and prevent some of these disruptions from occurring in the first place. So I think the instinct is positive. I think it's probably, I think there's a piece out just this week about how the NSC and ODNI have set up entirely new frameworks and processes around how these declassifications, as it were, get kind of processed and considered. But I think more broadly, when it comes to Russia, at least from my perspective, one of the underexamined aspects of these disclosures is granted, you wanted to let the Kremlin know that the world was watching, but maybe one of the implicit messages also was, you can't really trust your inner circle. We have you covered, or that you perhaps have insider threats of your own. So I think one of the potential byproducts there, if not an explicit goal, is to kind of undermine the Kremlin's sense of self and undermine Putin's sense of how much he can trust those who surround him. That takes a longer time to kind of manifest, and it's tougher to measure, but.
Yeah, and it's kind of exposes the bit of the shadow wars here, the messaging, the deterrence, exposing the vulnerabilities for a leader to become a little less confident, perhaps a little more insecure, and then might change behavior. Although my sense is Vladimir Putin, he doesn't lack for confidence, and he really is not one who's insecure about anything. Could be his undoing, but certainly the way he tends to operate. We're here with Gavin Wild from the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, really discussing intelligence world, cyber elections, and the conduct of Putin's Russia. You know, one thing that they've been successful at, Gavin, and certainly Putin has, is that even with a disclosure saying, hey, this is Russian intelligence either dumping or putting out misinformation and the like, and our intelligence community may or may not, do that. But if they do, it also relies on the trust and confidence of the American people, the media, political actors, elected officials. And of course, we've seen a significant degradation in that domain, where a National Intelligence Council statement may say X or Y, or a member of the National Security Council may say A, B, or C, doesn't necessarily translate to the actors involved or the country writ large, the electorate, accepting that. They just weave that into their conspiracy narrative that may be propounded that day by whatever social media channel he or she is following.
Yeah, I think that also speaks to, since 2016, there have been necessary conversations around kind of the quality of our media, the quality of our media literacy, the journalistic ethics that would come into play when you're dealing with materials that have been hacked and leaked. I'm confident, I know several, you know, outlets and journalists who have done some soul searching since 2016 to think about how they would handle subsequent leaks of that type. But I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the cautionary notes of, you know, the more frequent use of intelligence to get ahead of threats like this is that the very credibility of the IC is on the line. I think 2022 really helped Washington turn the page from kind of the yellow cake politicization of intelligence in the lead up to the to 2003 and the Iraq War, and kind of put a more credible face on how intelligence is used by policymakers. But again, it will only take you know, one kind of catastrophic slip up or politicization, if you will, to kind of set the intelligence community and the good work and the good people that it has working for it back again. And so I think they need to be very cautious and very astute in understanding that as much as particularly, you know, every department and agency would like to pride itself on being apolitical and objective, which they certainly strive to be, that the public perception can become reality. And
bad actors get bigger headlines, and there's certainly some of those in government, as we've seen. And so that's all contributed to it. But you seem to look at 2022, you just said, I think you said, turning the page. Take a minute explaining why 2022 was good from this standpoint, managed to kind of handle the misinformation, disinformation attempts by bad actors. I'm assuming that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, and the lead up to Russia's kind of full scale incursion into Ukraine. I think it was good to both let the public know that what we were seeing, and it served us well with allies and partners as the administration kind of went around Europe, kind of ringing the alarm bell, saying, "Look, this is what we're seeing." And as it ultimately bore out, I think it validated that was a useful exercise to kind of get some of the machinery going in trying to curry support for Ukraine and curry options to try and talk the Kremlin down off of this plan. So I think it validated itself well in the lead up to the war.
The event we participated in together in the Capitol a few weeks ago called Containing the Kremlin, thinking about what we can do to realize containment. You had a great observation as we talk about information warfare, Russia's information warfare capabilities. This is what you said. One that cannot only alter the battlefield outcomes, but bend an entire population to its will is really what they were seeking to do. This idea of bending the will. Talk a little bit as we migrate to Ukraine. Of course, as we're having this conversation, Russia's on the offensive in Ukraine. Ukraine is struggling to hold them off, fend them off, and they're in desperate need of additional munitions. The U.S. Congress is deliberating on whether or not it will appropriate funds to provide additional defense systems to the Ukrainians. But there's, in parallel with the kinetic effort, you have this cyber effort that really Russia seeks to bend the will of those on the ground and then around the world. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, so I mean, I think particularly, let's rewind the clock a little over a century ago. Like, most of the thinking about information from a Soviet perspective was, again, as I said, kind of this social engineering project. This wasn't just about, throughout the Soviet experience, it wasn't just about controlling the newspapers. It was about art and science and sculpture and dance and film, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that had kind of this semantic interaction with the public was designed to shape the new Soviet person or the new Soviet man and woman. And there's a great quote from Yevgeny Messner, who was kind of mid-century theorist in the Soviet Union, who talked about kind of insofar as it touched upon military and warfare issues, he talked about the soul of the enemy society. And he said this is the most important strategic objective, degrading the spirit of the enemy and preserving your own from degradation was this new struggle, and kind of it's a good touchstone for how I think strategic culture in Moscow thinks about information warfare. It's as much about the enemy society and eroding their sense of self as it is about any kind of battlefield objective. And you can kind of say, well, certainly there's a societal element of the way that we in the West or in the US think about war, and that's certainly true. But I think insofar as information warfare goes, I think it's easy for us to underestimate or kind of gloss over how central to Moscow's thinking this societal element is.
And have they been successful today, in your judgment, with this approach? And because this is Moscow, Putin's Russia. Then it's not a. This is a kind of dictator, not kind of dictator, autocrat, not seeking to lead a Politburo advancing some pure form of communism.
Right. This is essentially taking this approach and extending it outward, and kind of projecting this idea of domestic control and forcing it on, Russia's neighbors. But no, I would argue that at least with regard to Ukraine, that it's been a dismal failure. It makes all the sense on paper that you want it to, as long as you're theorizing about the nature of war, which all theorists are wont to do in military academies, etc. But I think the myth that they sold themselves on of using information, and by that I also mean kind of cyber attacks designed to cause disruption in the civilian realm, to make your daily life hard and immiserate your population. I think they sold themselves on the idea that if they could just make Ukrainians suffer enough, that Ukrainians would turn to their leaders and say, isn't there a better way? Or their leaders would feel kind of pressure to change course and capitulate. But certainly since 2014, that's not been the way that Ukraine has gone with regard to Russia. And it kind of, in watching all of this cyber and information warfare being directed at civilians in particular, it kind of reminded me of some anecdotes from World War II onward through Vietnam, etc., where air warfare theorists from the US or Britain or Germany or Japan all kind of talked themselves into the same rationale when it came to air warfare, that if we just hammer civilians hard enough and immiserate them and make daily life so unbearable, that will surely lead to the ultimate kind of capitulation by our adversaries. And unfortunately, in the majority of cases that some historians have looked at, that didn't turn out to be the case. And I think you're seeing some of that easy button warfare, as it were, being applied now in cyber and information space.
So that, translated as the Ukrainians are resilient. If anything, these sort of cyber attacks result in them becoming more fervent fighters, supporters of a free and democratic Ukraine, and they'll resist. Certainly, that's being tested right now. There's something we saw that Microsoft put out a report, and I think it continues to play out since this was back in 2022, that the integration between cyber attacks and actually kinetic attacks and the like, that's getting a little more tactical than the strategic information warfare that we're discussing. But do you see that as an area that Russia is getting better at and delivering perhaps operational success in its war against Ukraine?
I think it's an area where they may be getting better, but I think it still remains to be seen, and Russia's probably a good test case for the question of whether there's kind of a ceiling beyond which cyber attacks can be effective alongside kind of combined arms warfare generally. Cyber operations can certainly be will certainly continue to be kind of central to targeting and intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance on the battlefield. But cyber operations and attacks, insofar as they're designed to have any impact of their own, irrespective of the kinetic kind of bombings, et cetera, that might happen concurrent with them, I think it's very difficult. It's an extremely hard thing to do, to take cyber operations or cyber attacks and try to fold them into a broader maneuver.
Find arms, you know, is hard enough, but adding a cyber layer there in terms of the offensive side is quite difficult.
In particular, because sometimes you don't have kind of a capability ready at the moment when all of your kinetic forces might be ready. You don't necessarily know if you are going to be able to bank on the effect that you have in mind actually taking place. And hopefully your cyber attacks are sophisticated enough that they do only the thing that you've asked them to do. Those three things tend to work in tension with each other and tend to make adopting cyber attacks into a broader maneuver just extremely difficult. And so as you know, folks kind of put it bluntly, like you can't cyber a road or cyber a bridge, like you can bomb one.
Which, again, as you laid out, has its own limitations in terms of having strategic, kind of giving you strategic outcomes you seek. One of the things that's come out since February 2022 and prior, just before, with the Winter Olympics in China, is the no limits relationship between China and Russia. In the years since, we're just over 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine, we've seen that Iran has become really essential to Russia's war effort in terms of the kind of one-way drones, attack drones, suicide drones. And then we see North Korea supporting, as well as Venezuela in terms of supply chain. So you have this emerging axis, which strategists are trying to understand and see what the limits or the depths of that axis, you know, means, and how much coordination is actually playing out, both operationally on the ground in Ukraine and more broadly in terms of diplomacy and strategy. But Gavin, what is to kind of the level of coordination in your judgment between Russia, China, Iran in the cyber realm? Do you see any evidence that they're coordinating on that front, or to the extent that each country is operating in terms of this information warfare and the like, they're doing so independently, just on their own?
My sense, at least, is that, you know, terms like, you know, endless, limitless friendship, et cetera, you know, are good bumper stickers, but there's still an awful lot of distrust, I think wariness on the part of Moscow to become, in reality or perception, kind of an appendage of Beijing or a younger, a little brother of Beijing. And so I think there's still... Yeah. So I think if there were ever to be kind of a marriage of convenience in cyberspace, it's probably more likely to come between Russia and Iran than necessarily Russia and China. I think you've certainly seen an awful lot of cyber espionage that continues to take place between Russia and China that neither side tends to make a big fuss about, but it still goes on. As much as that axis, so to speak, kind of may be an alignment of interests, I think you know Ukraine is a good example across public-private boundaries, and you know NATO and Five Eyes are other kind of counterexamples, of which Russia could only hope to have those types of friends that they can trust not to spy on them, that they can trust not to. To come to their aid kind of implicitly and reflexively. And so I think, you know, strategic partnership or whatever you want to call it is certainly something we'd have to manage and be concerned about. But ultimately, I don't think, I think Russia is still probably green with envy in the types of allies and friendships that the U.S.
Our five eyes versus their five country axis they have. It seems to me probably on the cyber realm and intelligence realm, that's one that you really need a sophisticated, trusted relationship to develop it. But at the same time, there seems to be some sort of strategic coordination between the countries and operationally, and certainly in supporting the war effort, China, Iran, North Korea, they're involved and they're trying to help Russia succeed on the battlefield. Last item before we go to the lightning round. Again, we're with Gavin Wild, who is a fellow in the Technology and International Affairs Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, an expert in Russia cyber activity. The question I have here, just to wrap up, is Russia's efforts to bend the will, the language we used before, not just of Ukrainians, we discussed that, but of the American people. And there's no shortage of misinformation going around social media channels, main kind of television networks in print and elsewhere that seem to be parrying Vladimir Putin's preferred talking points. I'll give you a few examples. Ukrainians don't have the will to fight. They don't fight. They're not showing up. Of course, there are over 300,000 Russians that have been killed or injured in this war. 30,000 plus Ukrainians have died in this war. Anybody who's looking at this knows that this is a real fight, and a bit of a David Goliath fight, but both sides are fighting. Another example is that you can't trust the Ukrainians with anything because of not just their history of corruption, but present-day corruption. U.S. military platforms don't go in their hands, are being sold, in a black market. Not sure the Javelin missiles have a robust black market, but that's the narrative that's being shared and impacting the way some are talking about the war. You might be familiar with others, Gavin, but it seems to me that there is a concerted effort, and it has penetrated the mindset of many in the U.S. electorate and is contributing to concerns and skepticism some Americans hold for supporting Ukraine in their fight to defend against Russian aggression.
So I would say I think Moscow certainly looks for, and a whole lot of entrepreneurial kind of actors in that ecosystem, in Moscow's ecosystem, are looking for opportunities to further ingratiate themselves and drive wedges in kind of public opinion on issues of import to Russia. I think one thing I would kind of be cautious of is lending them more credit for some of those sentiments than they're necessarily due, and kind of to the detriment of kind of doing some soul searching domestically in, again, what are the drivers behind skepticism insofar as it exists for support to Ukraine, or because I think at worst, sometimes the trolling tactics and certainly the online propaganda tactics make an easy scapegoat and are distractive from more difficult questions we need to answer about our own strategic communications with the American public, addressing kind of whatever deeper domestically rooted drivers there are for those types of sentiments. Because I do think that we can do an awful lot better at communicating the degree to which U.S. support is not only pivotal for Ukraine, but services several of the U.S.'s grand interests. I mean, thinking in terms of the money and the attention and the national kind of security focus that since Reagan's time has been focused on what is essentially the Russian military, and the fact that Ukraine has done so much to hollow it out over the last 2 years, with really what are marginal sacrifices from a financial perspective.
Oh, yeah. It's been pennies of dollars we'd otherwise have to spend. No, that's right. I mean, we'll move into the lightning round in just a moment, but you did invoke the namesake of the Institute and this podcast program. You know, I think we may have pockets of this country parroting views or talking points that reflect what the Kremlin may be pushing out, but in the day, President Reagan, would have just taken it to the American people and used the power of persuasion, use our democracy and freedom of speech to our advantage, which of course he and our founders all believe was the comparative advantage. This decisive comparative advantage would allow us to, you know, overcome any form of misinformation. Perhaps some people today doubt that. But if you look at the polling that we've done here at the Reagan Institute and elsewhere, the majority, in fact, the supermajority of American people would like to see the United States continue to support Ukraine. 75% of Americans are on the side of Ukraine and want Ukraine to win. They see that as vital. So, you know, the Kremlin's not succeeding in this misinformation, and we tend to focus on pockets and perhaps some prominent voices that are lending credence to that point of view. But it is clearly a minority point of view, and one that, as you know, Gavin, we should take on and engage with and persuade.
Absolutely. And I would say it's very difficult to tease out what portion of that kind of sentiment would not exist were it not for, you know, the propaganda aspirations of Moscow. That's an impossible question to answer, but I would just... I think that approach is probably through the power of example and strategic comms versus anything that we can somehow deter or dissuade Moscow from being from expressing, you know, organically or otherwise, their preferences. I think we should just have confidence in our own ability to communicate, and more kind of less pessimism towards the American public and their ability to kind of sort nonsense from fact.
Gavin, let's go to the lightning round. Here's where I ask our guests to provide their favorite Reagan quote, speech, book. We'll take all three, two, or just one. What do you have for us?
Well, I was going to respond with welcome to the Cafe 80s, where it's always morning in America, even in the afternoon. But I found out Reagan didn't really say that. That was just his avatar on Back to the Future Part 2.
Great movie.
So no, my favorite one, I think, apropos of this conversation is this one, a quote, could something like this really happen? Could someone break into our most sensitive computers? And this was something that President Reagan asked after watching War Games at Camp David. And the response back from his Joint Chiefs was actually, it's probably worse than that, sir. And so that sparked an awful lot of the thinking that continues on to this day in thinking about it. Led to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It led to a lot of revamp of how we did thought about computer security and cybersecurity from a military perspective, and now onward into kind of a broader societal aspect. So,
right. Well, that's a first for Reaganism, the quote of Reagan's reaction to War Games, and that was what, Matthew Broderick early on. I think I had that right.
very
Gavin
early
Wild,
on.
Thank you very much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Roger.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Reaganism. New episodes premiere weekly every Monday on YouTube and all podcast streaming platforms. If you like this episode, be sure to let us know and share with a friend.